What? It's time to throw convention out the window. Get ready for the greatest summer of your lives.
This is the Extra Hot Grade Podcast, episode 362 for the week of July 5th, 2021. I am Random Collection of Electronics, David T. Cole, and I'm here with the pause that refreshes, Sarah D. Bunting. And not-so-devoted diva, Tara Ariano.
Who the hell is Bimelech?
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Extra Hot Grade for Independence Week. We are recording this very special episode in advance so that we can declare our independence from working for a few days. And we thought, why not go with a theme for this All Forcenings episode? In case you are new here, quick review of what a forcening is. Pretty much what it sounds like. Each of your esteemed panelists will be forcing another one to watch an episode of a television program. This can be a benevolent act in which the forcenee is finally introduced to something he or she would really enjoy but never made time for before. This can also be an act of war. We may be hearing more about that later in the episode. For this round of forcenings, I had us pick from a pool of shows with the word America in the title because it seemed appropriate given the timing. Pretty big pool of potential shows with also a lot of potential for fun and or heartbreak. Just like America itself. Wah, wah. So why don't we get into it? Tara, Dave, any other general forcening notes before we start?
No, let's just get into it.
All right. First up was Tara's forcening of me. Tara, would you like to explain?
I would. I forcened Sarah to watch Young Americans. This is the Dawson's Creek one half season spinoff from the year 2000. Were we ever so young Americans? It is not easily streamable anywhere, but it is on Daily Motion. I managed to track it down. And the first episode is in pretty good shape. I debated with some later ones where some of the more interesting and guest stars who became more famous later showed up, like Matt Jukri and Charlie Hunnam, yep, who are not in the pilot. But as the season goes on, whoever ripped them, they like flip the image and they're also stretched. And I was like, it's bad enough
dear
to give her this migraine episode. So I just stuck with the pilot. So let us know, was this did you regard this as an act of war?
Just looking at when it showed up in our rundown syllabus, no, I viewed this as a friendly, peaceful act. Mm-hmm. The experience of actually watching it, Daily Motion aside, I can't really use the word delight because the so-called acting often on display, not to mention the more problematic elements that the WB seemed to roll in like so much catnip during this period. Voyeurism played for laughs is one that is immediately present. Gay panic, obviously, via a highly ill-advised trans man isn't trans at all, but actually a young woman who's trying to get her parents' attention by rowing crew as Jake instead of Jacqueline. The possible incest storyline that is supposed to be scandalous, but is sunk immediately by the utter lack of chemistry between Mark Familietti as Scout and Kate Bosworth as whatever Kate Bosworth is doing woodenly on screen.
Bella.
Yeah, it's Kate Bosworth. This is a galaxy where suns go to die. Look, I liked her in Blue Crush, but her shties should have ended there. Just my opinion. Mm-hmm. Young Americans, as mentioned, was spun off of Dawson's Creek. It is a who's who of aughts names, many of whom we do still know. Zukri, as Tara mentioned, Charlie Hunnam, not in the pilot, also as Tara mentioned. Michelle Monaghan, who, if she was in the pilot, I did not see her. Ian Somerhalder, who is definitely in the pilot and is just Somerhaldering. I mean, you know, Rob Lowe for a new generation. Mm-hmm. He knows the job. He does the job. Some of these people, like, you know, most of the leads who are central to the first episode, honestly, rightly vanished below the horizon. Bosworth, I feel like Hollywood really tried it. She's still working, but Rodney Scott as backdoor piloteer, Will Krudsky, his last credit was the L.A. Noir video game.
Oh.
10 years ago. That's about right. In the defense of these pretty, pretty logs, the writing, I can't exactly use the word bad either. It is, Tara has a note.
I just wanted to say, this comes to us from Stephen Anton of the Hollywood Antons, Robin of the being behind the Pussycat Dolls, Jonathan, the hairstylist from the Bravo reality show Blowout. So Stephen created this show and then, like, pieced out of TV altogether. His only other credits are on the two Pussycat Dolls reality shows.
Wow.
So.
I mean, yeah. Well, directing this pilot, good old James Whitmore Jr.
Oh.
Of many, many 90210 episodes. Mm-hmm. The writing is not good. And in addition to relying heavily on scandalous, quote unquote, plotting, to draw eyeballs, Young Americans makes the rookie mistake of letting us hear, speaking of 90210, a character's allegedly good writing,
then
telling us how good it is, when it clearly is not. In this pilot, Will Krudsky is discovered to have cheated on the Raleigh and Fover, whatever, entrance exam. The cool teacher, more on this embarrassment in a moment, gives Will 90 minutes to retake the test and signs an essay on who Will Krudsky is. No teacher does this because no real teacher
cares.
Really wants to hear from a 15-year-old about their truths. Krudsky is also a snooze fest amalgamation of every John Hughes wrong side of the tracks or with something to prove is the first problem here. The second problem is that the essay itself is not even an essay. It's a paragraph and a shitty one that contains phrases referring to himself as this dreamer who doesn't have a chance. Furthermore, quote, I have known the comfort of my mother's arms and the violence of my father's disappointment, but everyone encounters obstacles. Word? It goes on like this, but despite the fact that it is not the assignment as given, and not how any 15-year-old townie in the history of towns or the world has ever spoken about an unstable home situation or anything else, cool teacher Mr. Racine, Finn, stops by Krudsky's room to say he's got good news and bad news. The good news is Krudsky passed the test. The bad news is you're a writer. Was he the writer of The Breakfast Club? Because this entire assignment obstacle is borrowed straight from that flick. And this is what was striking to me about the Young Americans. Besides, of course, the desire that I was suddenly and randomly seized with out of nowhere, I assure you, to guzzle any and all available Coca-Cola products.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about that historical note for those who don't remember, because
it's
actually quite subtle in the episode. Like, I saw a couple of Coke machines and that was it. But at the time when this premiered, the whole gimmick on the WB as it then was, and you see it on Daily Motion in, like, the bumpers out of commercials,
mm-hmm.
that it's, like, presented by Coca-Cola. And I remember at the time, Dave's idea was like, we should get Pepsi to sponsor this section on Television Without Pity, which then was still Mighty Big TV. That did not happen. That was that was an attempted throwback to, like, you know, the golden era of early TV.
The men of Texaco.
Yeah,
totally.
Or whatever. Yeah. Lucky Strike, Drama Hour, what have you.
I had completely forgotten this aspect of the production, which, given how notorious it was at the time, mm-hmm. this I feel like we hammered this constantly. And that Pam Ribbon, our esteemed colleague, who I'm pretty sure was assigned to recapping this event, Horizon, just mentioned Coke and ancillary Coke products. And like, occasionally she'd just be like, Fruitopia, whatever happened with that? Like, I mean, the welcome to O.co Stadium sponsorship of the show at the time, I think felt very intrusive and like we were on the edge of some like scary, dangerous place.
Yeah.
It would barely register to us now. Like gambling concerns are all over local sports networks. Like it's how we live now.
Well, Pepsi made a game show this year. So
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And like, I mean, I watched the challenge that the Zune just kept trying it with the Zune for years. Like we're also used to this now. So that's not a problem. And also I enjoy a frosty cold Coca-Cola in a green glass bottle in a small town. Mm-hmm. It's that this is a just shamelessly derivative, poreless Frankenstein of other better known teen properties.
Well, starting with the bridge character from Dawson's Creek, who is such a store brand, Pacey Witter.
God, yes, he really is. Even his parents, like, mm-hmm. I think that might have been the actor's actual parents. Or, I mean, how, they don't really look like him. So I'm just wondering what the casting call looked like. Mm-hmm. Like, what did the side say? Just like burly, ham-headed, probably abusive dad.
Yeah.
Worn down nub of mom. Rusted pickup, because of course, like as in country music, this character on TV and in film is not allowed to have a pickup truck within 20 years of the air date.
Yeah.
Sigh. The cool teacher is Dead Poets, Mr. Racine Society, as I referred to earlier. Here is a clip which was, I mean, it's so unbearable that it almost comes back around to hilarious. Dave, if you could play that.
Afternoon, gentlemen. My name is Finn. No mister is necessary.
Cool.
Just walks into the lake or stream or whatever.
What? It's time to throw convention out the window. Get ready for the greatest summer of your lives. Well, is anyone gonna get in the boat?
Humorous.
That was a cue.
Question! Who's the greatest writer that ever lived? Who's the greatest writer that ever lived?
Brandon
Faulkner. Interesting. Thoughtful.
Nope.
But wrong! Correct answer is William Shakespeare. He is my favorite. Remember, I'm not just here to teach you how to be a kick-ass crew team, but to edify you about the superstars of literature.
Oh, I've never heard of that one. Thanks. God, you were here, teach.
Also, what I don't know about crew is a lot, but I'm just imagining Tara, your sister, watching them, quote, rowing and having a stroke.
Yeah. It's, I don't know if this one ever so registered bad. For her, but this it is funny that it was like around the same time as the Skulls. Like they tried it with Kate Bosworth and they tried it with crew. Like it's just not that cinematic stop. And they did.
Yeah, they did. But I mean, look, Oxford Blues did have some lessons for us, and that was one of them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's every renegade teacher you've ever seen before, except somehow more boring. And he's styled to do this like Dennis Quaid and DOA thing that should work for me. It does not.
Yeah.
Will tells a story about a pie eating contest that if it were any, like he adds a thing at the end about it turning the lake blue. That is the only reason Stephen King didn't sue, since it's a straight lift from Stand By Me in the pie eating contest. like straight lift. Oh, also Stephen King doesn't give a shit about this show because it's Young Americans. No. Like, even the last shot of the three buddies is Dawson's Creek, but at boarding school and with maybe siblings who maybe want to do it. I think they even reuse the little pier that Joey is shown at the end of sometimes.
Well, probably, because they're definitely still in North Carolina, which is why it's extra annoying that the school is called Raleigh, R-A-W-L-E-Y,
even
We're supposed to be in Connecticut, but we're, you know, we're not. All of those productions were in North Carolina at the time. One Tree Hill also.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it. Like, I'm all for recycling your glass Coke bottles, but guys, like a little effort. I guess they just figured that nobody was, nobody who was watching was like old enough or had ever, I don't know, been to the library and would get these references. I don't know what they thought. So I could act like I'm superior and would not keep watching it, but if it rolled over into another episode, I would not have turned it off.
I wouldn't either. I also rewatched it like right. It ended right before we started taping today. It's bad for all the reasons you say, but it is compelling. And
I mean, it's awful, but it's there's something about just like remembering that time of like our lives as TV commentators. Yes. It's also like, oh my God, like this show would be old enough to drink alcohol. Is crazy. Clearly someone was drinking alcohol while writing this. It's unoriginal. It's sexual and gender politics are not even politics, ergo troubling. It expects us to believe that a string of Carterises are 15 years old and not 29. And several of these people had really better have found an excellent mutual fund. But I mean, what a time capsule. Truly, like it, the minutes just went right by. Like it is interesting to look at in the ways that it's bad. It's like not, it's non-aggressive, I would say.
I feel you have not talked enough, in my opinion, about how unbelievably horny this show is. Like, girls and boys are stripped down to their underwear running across a lawn, like, before the first commercial break. Like, there's one of the big fights that Will has with his roommate, Scout, who is the one who has the doomed affair with Bella because, as we find out before the episode is over, they're related. they have this, like, confrontation where they're, like, walking past whatever this, you know, underwear run was back to their room. They have a full, like, shirtless argument for no reason. Like, it's, like, you could have staged this at any other time. But
I think that's also, I think that's another derivation. Like, I think that's supposed to be a nod to Princeton's Nude Olympics, which had been canceled.
Sure. But then, there's also the Hamilton and Jake / Jacqueline storyline, which, like, yes, it is a problem that I don't think that they really try to make it out like Jake is trans, even though Catherine Menig, who plays her, is, like, very queer, would go on to be the super stud of the L Word, including in its revival. Like, she's so sexy, but she's also super sexy in drag. Because I think we find out in later episodes, like, she just thought the academics weren't rigorous enough at the girls' school, and that's why she came up with this scheme. But, like, her short haircut looks incredible. The the styles of the time for boys, like, she's in the quadruple XXL, like, t-shirt over a long-sleeve t-shirt and the cargo pants that, like, they both could fit in and they both seem like they would like to. Like,
yeah,
it's,
they do.
It's not that much of a stretch that she's passing.
No,
and speaking
it's
of
not.
Derivative, just one of the guys style.
Yeah.
But the thing that kept getting me while I was watching it is how much, and I'm going to put this in our chat and maybe you can link it in the show notes too, how much she in drag looks exactly like Paulo Costanzo in royal pants, like same bone structure. Like, put a perm on Jake.
I was getting a Culkin vibe.
Yeah, yes, that too. But their plot line, like, she's Hamilton is like on the roof. He's just bitching about how it's so hard to understand girls. And she's like intrigued because then he starts peeing and she peeks and then she like impetuously kisses him. And there's an immediate like, you know, we can't do this, whatever. And she's like, yes, let's just be friends. I agree. And then she's like, he doesn't know what's really going on here. And in the hall, he's like, oh, my God, I might be gay. But like not, I don't feel like it's that gay panicky. It's just like, oh, this is something I hadn't considered. It's like maybe Hamilton Fleming is a bisexual icon. We're not getting credit for.
I mean, I would put that down to Somerhalder.
Yeah.
Just fair. Like playing it very, just playing it very true and not cheating it, which is another thing he's good at. And I don't think, you know, he didn't have that look, that Kerr Smith look.
Yes.
It's like, oh no, we're going to have to French. But yeah, I mean, I think the show wants us to be scandalized by this, like very soapy otherness in a way that the actors are not necessarily like, the actors are like not willing to carry water for this somewhat retrograde take by the writing.
Right. I suspect there was a version of this pilot where Jake just was a boy and they kissed and then it went on from there. And then it got network noted to like, we already have one gay teen on our other show. Like, figure out how to do this where they're not actually gay, but they think they might be.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was fun to watch. Yeah. Sorry.
It was. And I mean, I am not sorry to have revisited it. And yeah, I may try to continue revisiting it because it's, I mean, it's so like fluffy and who cares-y and what a perfect summer show. And they aired it in the summer, right?
They did, yes. It's so 2000.
Oh, God.
In every way.
I know. Greenwich. It's a couple hours north of here. Okay. He's from town, not space.
Yep.
All right. Well, let us move on then. To my foreshadowing of Dave, I selected The Greatest American Hero, Season 3, Episode 8, Space Ranger, because I just felt like Dave should enjoy a, you know, Starlog Jam themed. And also, it's The Greatest American Hero. I am not sure if I know Dave's feelings on The Greatest American Hero or if he has any, but I feel like it's close enough in time and vibe, I guess, to other things that I know that he, if he doesn't actively enjoy them, has merrily tolerated for the good of the podcast. The A-Team and Magnum for sure, but then also Knight Rider, which I feel like he tolerates, like, you know, your cousin who eats paint. So this was not an act of war on my part, but I don't know how it will have been received. Dave, hit it.
I've never seen this show before, so only via the theme song, which is quite famous. So luckily, the credits are one of those credits that always just tell you the origin story, which, as far as I can tell, is this guy. He's got very curly blonde hair. He's a teacher. Yep. And then one day he gets Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters of the Third Kind by an upside-down salad bowl floating above him. And they give him a special suit that is the reason he has all the superpowers and later becomes the greatest American hero. But then as he's leaving the site of the encounter, he drops the instruction book, which is an actual instruction booklet, like a coil-bound Kinko's instruction book that says instructions on the front written in that 1970s Micron optical character recognition font they used to use at Sears, you know, to scan in the numbers. So that's where we start. Okay, I mean, that's an interesting premise. I want to be a superhero, but I don't have the instruction book.
Well, this is season three, so we may assume a lot of season one was spent like discovering what the suit could and could not do.
Yeah, but he still can't fly in season three properly. So it's been a while and he still hasn't figured it out. So I think that instruction book was pretty important.
Doesn't he have a like some sort of like Virgil for all of this?
Well, he's fallen in with Robert Culp somehow, who is an FBI agent, but it's not clear that he knows much more about the suit than Hinckley does.
Okay.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, aliens, question mark, came to Earth in UFO, dropped the suit, said, have at it. And he's like, all right. But then he took off and the instruction book was left behind. I don't know if he goes back and tries to look for it. If there's an episode where he's trying to like just like feel around the grass to see where that instruction book is. I don't know if they address that at all.
Right.
They used to have 51 minutes for these episodes, you'd think.
Well,
they covered that.
Speaking of which, the theme song, which we all know, like at first in my notes, I'm like, skip intro. Are you fucking kidding me? Of course, I'm not going to skip this intro. But then it's like, okay, two verses and choruses of this theme song is quite excessive. So this is why episodes were that long. But it is by the great Mike Post. It must be noted.
So that's the backstory. And then in this episode, I guess he's supposed to be a teacher to like troubled youth or a summer school teacher. I can't quite tell if there's a difference. It's just, you know, all the bad kids still have to repeat school in the summer. But anyways, he's teaching school and one of his students who doesn't really seem to have trouble learning because he's actually a really smart, geeky, nerdy guy, has created this satellite snooping device out of spare parts, like literally like part of it is a toaster and shit. Like it makes no sense that he can actually build microchips that you would need to do the work that he does. But it's okay. It's fine. It's a time long ago when, you know, electronics just worked. You know, in the same way that old people think the internet just makes things happen, you know, that was sort of the same technical literacy we're dealing with. So this student who's given himself the name Space Ranger has created this satellite snooping device that lets him tap into the feed of satellites in geosynchronous orbit around the Earth, which he likes to say a lot. And he is using this info to call the various, I'm not sure if he's calling the FBI or CIA. I think it's the CIA.
The CIA.
And he's trickling them information from this in order to develop credibility with them. And there is some later questions like, why did he just go straight to them? And it's never really answered to anybody's satisfaction. This is just something he does because he's young and he's dumb and he thinks he'll be a superstar. If he can send them, the Russians are doing this and there's movement here and all this sort of stuff. So then the Russians actually are on his tail. They notice that everybody wants this technology. So basically it's two government agents all meeting in the same place, trying to get the same technology. And the greatest American hero is in the middle of this. I don't even know his name. I couldn't remember his name. That's how memorable
his character
is. I don't either.
Hinckley is his last name. I forget his first name.
Yeah. The lead is a nothing. Like, he's not adding anything to this show. Terrible acting. Really does not emote. Is not believable. The most convincing thing, and it is not convincing, is him pretending to fly while he's sitting on the, you know, the blue screen block in some studio while the footage rolls behind him. Like, it's, you know, roll that beautiful bee footage.
His feet, the way his legs are, like, they just are so big.
You can absolutely tell he is doing this on a table.
Of course.
It's just dangling.
Yeah.
I think that's even in the credits.
Yeah. And the suit itself looks like shit. Like, it just looks like someone knitted it.
It's got, like somebody's like, Halloween costume.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, he's got, like, spats over his shoes, like, and then every time someone sees him in it, he's got to be like, oh, I'm just wearing this costume, like, as a bit. Like, no one cares.
Yeah, the Clark Kentian lengths they go to make sure that somehow his identity is preserved. Like, first of all, if it's a problem, like, wear a mask or something.
Yeah.
Like, maybe the aliens should have thought of that. But, like, Space Ranger, who is your typical Revenge of the Nerds looking nerd with the big glasses, and I think he's got tape in the middle of it and everything. Every time that the greatest American hero saves him from something, it knocks his glasses off. Like, it's a very Velma in Scooby-Doo scenario, and it happens at least twice in the episode, maybe three times. You know, the show is both very lazily written, but also fueled by cocaine, and it's a very interesting combination of things.
Yeah. I think I also picked this because of the guy who played the dad in War Games is also in this. Like, he's Bert.
I saw him in the credits, but I don't know who he was in the episode.
And then Zabka is also in it. So it just seemed very 80s.
And Benny Bandina, J-Lo's manager now. Very, very rich man. This is the origin story.
But it was a particular time in the 80s because there's this whole scene or scenes devoted to the microwave.
Yes!
In hero household, the heroes, Mr. and Mrs. Greatest American Hero. Mm-hmm. And it is like one of those giant fake wood covered microwaves. She is going to make a gourmet meal totally inside of the microwave. She being Greatest American Hero's wife's Connie Selica, is that her name?
It's right? Connie Selica. Her name is Pam.
So Robert Culp's coming over, and they're going to have dinner. Turns out, in the meantime, Space Ranger's also going to come over, and they're all going to get microwave chicken done in 3 minutes. Which, they're all dead. Doesn't really matter what happens the rest of the episode. Because anybody took a bite of that chicken, they are now dead.
Yeah. Great.
But they go deep on this microwave. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a scene where the nerd Space Ranger repairs it, you know, because they had to reverse the polarity of the thingamadoober and blah, 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 and he fixed it. But then, like, they're going to make chicken, they're going to make dessert, they're going to do everything in this microwave.
They're going to fill William Atherton's house with popcorn.
Like, it really was the episode of 30 Rock where Jack Donaghy has to get the new microwave going, and there's posmens for the new microwave, and blah, blah, blah. Like, it really was ridiculous. I suspect this episode might be the genesis of somebody's fever dream in the 30 Rock writing staff. It all kind of came together.
Yeah.
So the project that he is working on, this spy thing that he kind of accidentally created and now is trying to use to try to get in at the CIA, is also his school science fair project, which he is in a group project with a bunch of sweat hogs, basically.
Yep.
And the sweat hogs have done zero work.
Nothing.
Nothing. And they're, like, worried about this project. Like, you know, how's it going? Like, it is group project dynamics to a T.
Yes.
When you're the smart one in the group.
Yes.
They never really address that to my satisfaction.
No, I agree.
Like, they, at the most, the sweat hogs gave him one ride to somewhere, and that was their contribution. And then at the end of the episode, just skipping ahead for a second, you know, there's a shootout, and the original one gets busted up. Their contribution is to go through the family's shitty, unused, unwanted electronics, put them in a giant pile in the table and say, look, we've got you more raw materials to make your super high-tech satellite snooping device again.
Yeah.
Like, if you could make a satellite snooping device out of I swear to God, there's a toaster in the mix, like somebody's radio, guitar amplifier. Like, why would the governments of the Soviet Union and America be chasing this guy? They could just be pumping these out by the dozens at whatever factory, you know, they could get their hands
just
on.
Just go to any landfill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scrape off the electronics.
It really was like one step below short circuit, where it's just like, all these things, and now I got a robot. And it's like, all these things, and now I have the ultimate satellite snooping device. It's ridiculous. Yes. The other great thing to behold in this episode is the terrible fighting.
Yes.
Nothing seems like it's connecting. Like, whoever was the stunt coordinator did a really poor job training these actors. But better than that is that I guess when the Greatest American Hero has clothes over his super suit, it doesn't work or something. Because every time he gets into a fight, there's this prolonged, awkward undressing of his outer layer so that he is now the Greatest American Superhero, suited red suit, silver, black kind of guy. And they show it. Like a fight starts and he kind of like scrambles behind a chair and like starts taking off his jacket and his tie and stuff. We already know what Superman does. He just opens up his shirt and he's done. But this guy takes, like, there's a fight going on, and he is not in the fight for a good minute.
Folding his clothes, just making sure his socks are still right side out. And
they show him
together.
Taking off his pants.
They do.
They show him taking off
steaming
his pants.
Steaming the pants, carefully hanging him on a ballet. Chair.
Yes.
Yeah. And he's kind of has to a little bit, like, he'll start doing this, and one of the Russians will come after him. He'll be like, whoa, and he'll, like, push him away a little bit and, like, go back to...
I don't
to,
have my steamer.
Oh, my God. It just, like, it is appropriately awkward, I guess, for a guy who doesn't know how to use his superpowers, but also you've had at least 35 years of undressing experience as a human. I feel like right. You should be better at that part of it.
Yeah.
And then he really just can't use a lot of his superpowers properly. Like in this episode, it's mostly that he has trouble flying. he's always like his pitch and yaw are always off.
Yeah.
So all the agencies end up fighting each other in the school gym where the science fair project is going on. The thing gets blown up. Space Ranger finally kind of gets acceptance vis-a-vis the Sweat Hogs giving him more raw materials so he can finish the project that they're not helping on is the end of the episode. Hooray for school.
I mean, that's true.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need that kind of verite, but thanks, show.
So, in conclusion, I've seen one. I don't need to see any more.
All set?
I feel like they're all the same.
I'm sure they are.
You know, because it is of that era where they'll just reset the show. You know, there's no continuity. You know, they could have another exploratory microwave party in season 4, and it would be exactly, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like this is just Chuck, but before they had the tools to actually like do it properly. And then they just didn't like, I feel like Chuck sort of leaned into that like unwilling heroic tool thing and didn't have to rely so much on like good fighting and good graphics and stuff like that. But I feel like there were a bunch of shows that in the 80s, it was like, you know, what's hot right now is computers. And then they just did not have the tools to back up any plots that they came.
Or the technology.
Up with. Right. Yeah. Right. That's
like
what I mean.
The Russians are using a contemporary era video game. You know, the ones where it was just a series of LED lights, you know, on a grid. It was basically, if you imagine the electronic battleship, a little bit smaller handheld. It was just like, you know, and this is with their tracker devices, stuff like that. Yeah. There's a lot of geek dragging. Like geeks are, a geek is definitely something you do not want to be in this show.
Yeah.
Either you don't want to be called a geek by the Sweat Hogs. The teacher's like, no, you're not a geek. Like, it's really like, oh my God, you've got the stink of geek on you. That's 100% bad. Like there's not we're not quite there yet with nerd geek culture where we've started to flip the script where soon you will rule the world because these computers you're working on will run the world.
But yes.
We're not quite there yet.
This show also apparently had a whole lot of problems with his last name being Hinckley and it premiering when it did. And I think they thought about changing it, but then they just held it. And then it was sort of like, after all of that, it's this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, this is most of TV, though. It's like her and then it's gone after however many episodes.
Yeah. Well, this is a Stephen J. Cannell joint and not one of his better ones. But it also has the same the same quality that I have seen in other episodes of his shows and shows of this era, where it's like it's very tightly plotted at the beginning. There's a lot of establishment because every episode is a standalone. Like there's no serialization. So there's a lot of like, I mean, not world building, but there's a lot of like establishment of what's happening front loaded. And then it just keeps going. And then like to your point, it was, you know, 53 minutes or whatever. It just comes to a point where they're at the climax and it's clear the writer is just like, I'm sick of writing this. Like, just wrap it up. It's because like, they abduct Alan, the geek, the space ranger, from the science fair. He's in a helicopter, and then like he's fighting with the pilot. He's trying to like get a you know, miss with the controls or whatever, so he can get back on the ground. And the pilot just like pushes him out. And it's like, I thought you were abducting him. Like, why was he even in the helicopter if you didn't want to take him somewhere?
Oh no!
Yeah. So it just
guys.
Just seems like they were like, that's enough. Wrap it up.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of wrapping up, my last point is one of my, like, it was weirdly one of my favorite moments because it happened 3 times in a row. I'm like, that's not right. Was Robert Culp at the end corners a couple of the Russian agents or something like that. And he's got 2 guns all the time, which is like a strange thing for the time.
Yes.
Going akimbo with the pistols. But this is what he said. He keeps on saying, freeze it. And I don't think I've ever heard anybody say freeze it all the time. Yeah. And I thought, like, maybe just once. But no, he says it three times. Freeze it. Freeze it. I mean it. Freeze it. And it's like, freeze it? It? It's just, like, it's too much. It's like, it's, first of all, you just want to shout one word, right?
Right.
It's a moment of clarity you need to have. And you need to communicate this clarity to the people that may not be freezing it. It's too close to a polite request when you add the it.
Right.
And he says it three times. And yeah, it's kind of
freeze
great.
It right there, buddy. Take it easy.
Just generally, I'm going to say strong drunk energy wafting off Robert Culp in this performance.
Yeah.
I mean, look, you don't get just anyone to play the mayor at Turk 182. You need a drunk guy who yelled freeze it on The Greatest American Hero.
The wife is wine. Culp is hard liquor. William Catt is like Quaaludes or something. Like, everybody's on something, and it obviously is affecting their performances.
Yes.
And I mean, their character becomes that vice of choice, I think.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right, so it is my turn to force Tara, and I was thinking, what show could possibly have the word American in it that we, A, have not watched, B, something I've heard about before, and says, yeah, maybe someday. And then I was thinking, I remember our good friend David Ellis Dickerson was a writer of the American Bible Challenge. So I thought, that's got the word American in it.
Yep.
What's more American than quizzing each other on Bible stuff? So I said to Tara, let's watch the most recent season finale.
Yep.
And that's what we did. And oh, boy.
Yeah. Oh, boy. So, you know, I obviously cannot tell you how the gameplay goes in the episodes leading up to this because I'm never going to watch them. But we've gotten it down to the three strongest teams, I guess. And they're teams of three who have a pre-existing relationship. And they all are playing for charity, which I think is great, although some of them are Christian charities. I mean, all of them are, but, you know, whatever. Christian charities do good work, too. So they are the Bible Belt. Their gimmick is that they provide martial arts lessons as well as Bible study. That's their ministry.
Okay.
The Devoted Divas, the only all-female team, and then Rhymes with Grace, who are three, like, tall-haired 20-something guys. I don't know what rhymes with Grace, but that's the name of their team. There's also, we get teased multiple times. There's going to be a musical performance by presumably a gospel artist, someone I've never heard of, Natalie Grant, whatever that was, did not make it to Netflix because we got to the end and was like, wait, like they kept the teases in, but not the actual performances. So this is a trivia game about the Bible.
The Bible.
The Bible.
It's not about the challenge. Fuck.
No. And the thing about this game, and, you know, if you know anything about, like, Christian trivia, like, there definitely is an aspect of it where it's, like, learning, you know, which verses correspond to which numbers and stuff. Like, there's a lot of competitiveness, and people learn a lot about the Bible, so they have a lot of facts in their minds just from basically memorizing passages. And so the thing about this show, though, is that it is exclusively for people who know a shit ton about the Bible. Like, I feel like my knowledge of the Bible is, like, medium to low. I mean, I was in a great books program in university. I had to read, like, Bible chapters and stuff for school. And I went to church for, like, a lot of my childhood. But, you know, Catholics are not so much with the, like, indoctrination of, like, lines. You're not expected to know a lot other than, like, big picture stuff. The whole Catholic thing is, like, priests will interpret that for you. You don't need to read the
Bible.
Whole
thing is you should know too much.
That too. Yeah.
I mean, Baptist is just like, I'm sure there's something in there about how you're not supposed to dance, but, like, our sect was not like that, so.
Right.
We could experience joy.
So I'm going to walk you through what the games were, and just, I want you just to know, it has, unless you are already in this world and are, like, planning to apply to be on the show, it has no playability factor along with it because all the questions are so, to me, very obscure and real hard.
If you've watched The Simpsons, as you watch the Flanders play bombardment of Bible questions, yes. That is the level of questions that you get on this show. Like, it really is. Figures in the Bible you've never heard of, scenarios you've never heard of. There's, like, you know, it's just, it's not for lay people, for
No.
So I have some representative clips, which we'll get to. So the first game is called Scripture Prescriptions, which basically there are, you know, people in the Bible have medical problems. What did the Bible passage say to do for whatever was wrong with them? And these are multiple choice. So, like, what are you trying to cure if you are told to stare at a metal snake on a pole or something? And it was a snake bite, I think. I already forget. Clearly none of this sank in. Jeff Foxworthy is the host, by the way, and his, like, zinger on this one is, like, it's easier to understand than Obamacare. And, like, I hate to agree with this show for completely opposite reasons from what he intends, I'm sure. But that's the first game. Yeah.
It's not bad. God damn you, Jeff Foxworthy.
I know. So the Bible Belts are, like, dominant so early. Spoiler, they win. But they're like, just wiping the floor of the other two teams. The Devoted Divas are, like, too fast on the buzzer, like, keep buzzing in with. So the second game is called Adam, ADD, apostrophe, EM, and Even. And the concept is it's biblical equations. And the Bible Belt guys, like, he clearly explains what it is. It's like the number of blah minus the blah, blah, the number of blah. And that's the equation, right?
Sure.
But the Bible Belts jump in, like, after he's just said the first part of the equation. And he's like, no, you have to hear the whole thing to do the math. And then after he's just told them that, the Devoted Divas jump in immediately and give the same answer. He's like, still right, but calm down. Actually says patience is a virtue sometimes, but anyway, please play clip one, Dave.
The number of Jesus's broken bones plus the number of Revelation elders' thrones. The Bible Belts.
Zero. Jesus' bones weren't broken. The number of Revelation elders' thrones, 24. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. So 24. Our answer is 24, Jeff.
Zero plus 24 equals 24. I say it equals 100 points. Yeah! Good job. Yeah!
There's not going to be a lot of Jersey accents on this show, are there?
No, just
guessing.
So after the commercial, then we get Stick a Fork in It. And the concept of this game is you have five cups. Each cup is labeled with the name of a person who dies in the Bible. Jeff is going to read how the person died. You have to first identify which of the five in front of you died by that means. And then this is like an extra area at level of complication that's like for no reason. Then you're supposed to use a bunch of spoons that they have there to like flip a fork into the cup. So like that doesn't even test what you know, really. Like the Devoted Divas only get one in because the flipping is super challenging. Like no one mm-hmm. does well in it. But anyway, in addition to that, the fork game is way too hard. Clip two.
All right, here are your five names of people who died. Balaam, Eglon, Herod, and that's Herod Archelaus, Joseph, and that is the Joseph from the book of Genesis, or Moses. Let's put 60 seconds on the clock, and here is your first obituary. Go. At this person's funeral, his donkey could have given the eulogy.
Balaam. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah! So it goes on like that for a minute. So it's like however many you can answer correctly and flip forks in. For these five people that like, okay, I know there's two Herods. I don't know which one that is. Like, no idea.
Herod of intercourse. No.
Right. So then there's another commercial. Herods. Then there's also a live gospel choir, which is led by Kirk Franklin, who is like a legit gospel star that I actually have heard of. And when I saw it was him, I was like, oh, damn, that's actually a pretty good get. So he's leading the game, which is called Moses Town, where clues are going to be sung to you in a Motown style. And then you have to answer a question. So I have a clip of that one, too. Please play clip three.
Clap, y'all.
All right, Divas, here's your question. The choir just sang a song about Jesus sending out his disciples two by two. Here's your question. What did Jesus tell his disciples to shake off them when a town rejected their preaching?
I think it wasn't it like the dust?
The dust.
Dust.
You gotta have the lips pursed like that. You know what? You are absolutely right. It was dust.
So the gloating is really unmerited because that's like the second correct answer that they've given in this whole episode, and we're over a third of the way through.
And if our reprobate asses knew that, come on, guys.
Yeah. Like, this, it's fun. The singing is great. Like, the singers are really talented, but it's always the same tune, which yeah, I feel yeah.
But the last
lazy.
One is like, watch out or God's going to come and fuck you up. Like, it was yeah. really, well, they're doing that song. Da, 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 da. You better watch out because he's always watching you, you little fuckers. Like, it was so menacing in that way yeah. that, you know, Old Testament is. But, yeah. like, mm-hmm. it was like... take a step back. Let's marry the message with the music, please.
Because Elf on the Shelf of Brimstone. I really am tempted to pretend that one of these is a segue into a game time, but I'm not going to do it.
No. So then we get the Zoo Testament, where it's questions about animals in the Bible. And sure. for the first two, Jeff comes out handling the animals in question. So he comes out with a scorpion in his hands, and the team is like dithering, and Kirk Franklin is finally like, give an answer, he's holding a scorpion.
Seriously?
Like, kind of funny. Oh. Then he comes out with a boa constrictor, which like a PA is helping him with, and I swear to God, it's the same boa constrictor from I'm a Slave for You, from that performance mm-hmm. at the VMAs. And then the last one is about a bear, and they do a whole bit where, like, he's fighting with a bear behind, like, this, you know, scrim or whatever, and then it's a PA that's just got, a bear sleeve on. Ha ha, there's no real bear. Another commercial. Then they have a category called The Chosen Three. Dave, what could they also call it?
Well, The Chosen Three is very, very close to the Threequalizer, except it's got three answers, but you get six choices. You get you. It's not like multiple choice, basically. So it's a little easier than the Threequalizer, but it's okay. kind of the same concept.
Right, the Threequalizer from the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show.
And I will say the Threequalizer in the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show was Taylor Cole's creation. So I'm gonna have to ask him if he's a big fan of the American Bible Challenge, because
yeah,
there's some similarities.
When he makes up songs, do they sound like that? Because
No.
No,
but these ones, for the 15th time, way too hard. One of them is like, which of these pharaohs is named in the Bible? And they put up all the names, and I'm immediately like, well, Ramses is not. Like, all of the other ones, I have no idea. Yeah. And then Dave noticed, when people get an answer wrong, the other teams are like, praise God. It's like, I get it, but it's also kind of rude.
But it really does play in today's sort of like, you know, red Trumpian American exceptionalist religious thing where it's like, I got mine, fuck you,
right.
praise Jesus. Like, it really did play into, I mean, this is a little, I mean, what is this, like 3-4 years old, I think?
Something like that. It's a little gentler than that.
Thoughts and prayers.
Pretty cringy.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also a thing where, like, because there's three of them, you know, there's one category where only one answers, and then that person has to sit out for another one where two answers, but, like, whatever. I didn't keep track of who. No one's going to watch this. It doesn't matter. So the dashing, or the devoted divas, they end up in last place, but they still get to keep the $27,000 that they previously had won, which is like a pretty good chunk of change for
Isn't
a game
dashing
show.
Dashing Diva where you got your nails done in New York
dashing
City?
Dashing Diva is where I got my nails done when we lived in New York. It was a half a block away.
Good champagne.
So, yeah, it was a good place. Anyway, yeah. That's beside the point. The final category is lightning round, but it's called the final revelation. The category is minor prophets, and they have gotten a chance to study before they go into it. Yes, Dave.
I was going to say, what does this show and your nail place have in common? Mm. They're both really happy when they deal with nails.
That's true.
Yeah. Oh.
So they play this one Family Feud Speaking style where both teams get the same questions, yeah. and they're like, you know, the second team is in isolation while the first one is answering. So the rhymes with grace went first. They only get three. And then So,
but they got like boom, boom, boom. And then it was like the last 50 seconds, they're just like, ah.
Just eating shit.
Yeah.
So, but they were playing for something called the Home of Grace. And one of the guys is like, you know, we especially want to expand a center for pregnant and expecting mothers. And I was like, of course you do. But then I looked it up. It's a rehab mostly, and it's rated 4 out of 4 on Charity Navigator. So no problem with that. Good for them.
Okay.
Although they do have Mike Huckabee's face on the homepage. The Bible Belts are playing for their own.
He's the father.
Playing for their own ministry.
I was going to say he's acceptable birth control.
He's hucking more than bees.
Oh, gross.
Anyway, I've already given it away. The Bible Belts win a total of $140,000, which is like going to completely wipe out the waiting list for their biblical martial arts classes, which we see, presumably their wives, have had t-shirts made that say Kicks for Jesus. Do I kind of want one? Yes.
I don't not want
but anyway,
one.
Congratulations.
Is it a poly blend?
No, it is absolutely pink Gildan.
It's a Gildan for sure.
Oh, yeah.
So that was
BFTs or get the fuck out. Yeah, try blends are the work of the devil. Too expensive, too form-fitting.
I actually think there is biblical passages about blending fabrics.
Oh, there absolutely is.
Yeah. Anyway, that's the American Bible Challenge. It was like, I admired how much it was pushing me away from liking it. Like, this is the most aggressively not, you know, we say it
yeah,
a lot.
But the flip side is, this is a show that knows this audience.
Yes.
Right? I mean,
that's
this is
saying.
A niche show.
Yes.
That doesn't compromise in that regard.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of other weird little problems with the show.
Yeah.
But generally, I thought this was going to be way more of a shit show than it ended up being. Like, not for us, obviously, but competently made.
For sure.
A reasonable amount of questions for a game show in today's era where, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, you know, averaging one question for every 7 minutes or whatever it is. Like, it was not bad in that regard. It's just we knew nothing about the subject matter.
Yeah. And I also want to give a shout out to Jeff Foxworthy, who's, like, a good host, very personable, kept things moving, like, you know, had good wild lines, like, good at improv. Like, you know, he knows what he's doing.
He really is America's host. He can, like, both sides of the aisle. I mean, a show like this is not for, you know, godless blue staters like us, but.
Sure. Yeah. But like Dave said, like I'm not joking when I say I admire how much it committed to just being what it was.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the audience that it's for absolutely love it, and they should. Like they probably have to deal with a lot of really shitty programming, and this is upper tier.
But speaking about the audience, the one note I would give this show is, boy, you are sweetening this way too much. Like, there are scenes where you see the audience and they're just sort of like standing there and politely clapping, you know, like white people at a concert. And the sweetening is like, woo, woo, woo. And there's actually a loop that I heard 4 times during the show because there's this one particular shrill, you know, hooper holler in the background. And I'm like, okay, there's sweetening and then there's like, you know, wish fulfillment, right? Yeah.
Yep.
But it wasn't bad. It wasn't a bad show.
Yeah. Nope.